You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming along to the Brookings Institution's Foresight Africa event. I'm excited to be here. My name is Yinka Adigoke. I am the Africa editor of Quartz, digital online news outlet based here in the US, but we have coverage across the continent with reporters there. This discussion is going to be about the top priorities for Africa in 2017. As well as yourselves, we'd also like to welcome viewers, I guess we'll call them viewers, on the webcast. And we love for the people who are watching remotely and even people in this room to join in the conversation via Twitter with the hashtag Foresight Africa. I'm going to introduce the panel. I'm very excited about the panel because most of the people on here, I'm kind of a little bit of a fanboy of most of their work, either directly or indirectly, not actually realizing that I had quoted them at some point in the past. To my immediate left is Amanu Si. He's the senior fellow and director of the Africa Growth Initiative here at Brookings. Next to him is Angel Kuemo from Washington Media Group, which is a communications group, but is also building an Africa lobbying unit as well. Next to her is Whitney Schneidman, also a fellow here, a non-resident fellow here at Brookings, and has done a lot of work on the continent with investment and private companies. And right next to him is Ken Opalo, who is... you're here as a professor at Georgetown University, and he does a lot of work on governance and political economy in Africa. So, welcome. So I'm going to ask you a question I believe we've asked on our blog. I'm going to ask everyone just very quickly, and I'll start with Ken. I'll start from the far side. what are your top priorities for Africa in 2017?
First of all, thanks for having me. I'd like to thank Amadou and his team for inviting me to be part of this panel. In terms of 2017, I have three quick top priorities. One would be to see advances in political development. And by political development, I just mean the capacity to of African states to provide solutions to emerging problems. Via the political processes, whether they're democratic or not. And in this regard, you know, I'd like to I'll be keenly watching improvements in administrative capacity. You know, can African governments manage their budgets? What's the absorption rate? You'll be surprised to find out that, you know, lots of countries or subnational governments in Africa do not get to spend all the money that they get each budget year to spend. That should be a much bigger concern for those of us who care about development priorities of African governments, and I would argue much more than corruption. And then, you know, thinking critically about professionalization of the administrative services in Africa. I would also think about accountability, and this is both administratively and politically. The second concern factor that I'll be looking at will be the question of political economy of debt in Africa. So, you know, about 10 years ago, African countries rushed to get debt in the private markets. And you know, with the collapse of oil prices, the oil producers are in trouble. And then, you know, in the non-oil producers, you have problems like Mozambique's. In which case, you know, the private market has somehow failed to discipline governments. This should be worrisome. Theory should tell us that when governments borrow in the private market, they're supposed to be more fiscally responsible, but what we're seeing is that fiscal responsibility has failed. And watchdogs like the IMF have also failed to track this problem. And then lastly, subnational governance in Africa. So a lot of African governments have tried to bring government closer to the people, either through federal systems, like in Nigeria and something close in Kenya and South Africa, or in Uganda style, which is just a proliferation of subnational units. These provide opportunities for policy experimentation and bringing accountability closer to the people. So those would be my top three this year.
Excellent. Thank you. Whitney?
So my number one issue is Trump in Africa. I don't want to say it keeps me up at night, but sort of. And in that, I think that we have to keep an open mind. And remember that when President Clinton entered the Oval Office, he'd had no prior experience in Africa. And that when George Bush entered the Oval Office, he'd had no prior experience. And both, I think, left very positive legacies. And even President Obama, who had more experience than all U.S. presidents combined, it took him a whole administration to get to Africa. So that's number one, keeping an open mind about what the Trump administration may do in Africa. Now, with that open mind, I was encouraged on election night when he identified infrastructure in the U.S. as one of his priorities, because I can't think of a more relevant issue to focus on in Africa than infrastructure and infrastructure development. And I think actually that could be quite a very positive legacy if he were to move in that direction. And it could have benefits to his more fundamental agenda here in the United States in terms of job creation. Because in 2015, we had about $18 billion worth of exports to Africa. That supports more than 120,000 jobs here. So if you get U.S. companies exporting machinery and components and other things, that's going to have a direct impact on productivity in the United States. But I would hope they'd go one step further and get more U.S. companies involved in the infrastructure build-out. And when I say infrastructure, I'm talking about transportation infrastructure, health infrastructure, financial infrastructure. And I think the U.S. has a much larger role to play than up until now. And I think the last point, priority that the Trump folks might take on is sort of leveling the playing field in Africa, which to my mind is increasingly tilted against the U.S. And I say this because when you look at the European Union Economic Partnership Agreements, these are free trade agreements with virtually every country on the continent, which gives European companies, goods and services, preferential access to the African market. So right now in South Africa, for example, U.S. companies face tariffs of around 18 to 20%, where European companies are at about the 1 or 2% level. And this is going to play out across the continent. You put that with China, which subsidizes a lot of the companies who bid on infrastructure projects. And then you put in the U.S., what I think is an over-exaggeration of risk in Africa. And we're at a real deficit position. Right. So I'm hopefully we can level the playing field in that way over the next several years and get a stronger U.S. Right. commercial component. The kind of component that's creating jobs, that's transferring technology, that's developing skills, that's hiring locally, that's sourcing locally, and really contribute to the economic development process.
Yeah, I have a few more questions back on that. We'll come back to it.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you very much, Inka. And first of all, I want to thank the Brookings Institute for inviting me on these important discussions, and I feel extremely humbled to be surrounded by PhDs. I hope I will do. I'll be up to the
task.
I'm
not one of them.
Both of us. Okay, good. We are good people. to jump on what Dr. Whitney just said on the what to expect from the Trump administration, I would say that compared to 8 years ago when we have highest expectation. We thought we all said, because you have a brother who was going to the White House. I think today we all speculating. And doing that from the disappointment, I would say we can only be happy unless things go really, really wrong. But I don't think it would go wrong, because if President-elect said his priority is to serve the American people first, which is good, and that's what he's supposed to do. If you remember that Africa is of strategic importance to the U.S. I know I'm preaching to the choir regarding that. Now, we have historical relations. Our relationship with the U.S. was started four centuries ago. I don't think it was great at that time, but we had a lot of improvement. But we have, I think Africa policy absolutely fits the rhetoric, because if you want to save jobs, if you want to maintain the relationship with 54 countries who represent a powerful voice in other international platforms, we still need to engage with Africa. And for other obvious reasons, you all know, the natural resources, human resources, strategic position, next frontier. I don't need to elaborate on that. But the continent is important to the U.S. It's not just engaging the continent because the continent deserves it or because we like the continent. Mm-hmm. It's because it's important for American national security. In that sense, I think we will see some engagement. And the other thing is the fact that African issues are always bipartisan. AGOA was bipartisan, and obviously PEPFAR, MCC. We don't see a lot of controversy when it comes to engaging. However, the question is how, what he would do, and how far he would go. And assuming that he will at least maintain the status quo on the policy that are really good already, Power Africa, good for infrastructure, AGOA, very successful, created 120,000 jobs here, and then also close to 300,000 direct jobs in Africa, and maybe 1.2 indirect jobs in the continent. So I think I'm optimistic. I like to hope, because I think we have some common sense policymakers at the White House. So that being said, I did a little bit of research and run a survey with members of Believe in Africa and see what they like to see, the top three agenda. What came up on top was democracy and security, of course. We cannot build a prosperous society without democracy. 2016 was a big year on election. Every year in Africa, you have a very interesting election. We closed with Gambia, with the drama, but we closed with Ghana, the good story. Next year, we have to see what's going on with DRC, Rwanda, Kenya. But it's always a little bit, we're always a little bit nervous, but things always go. I'm optimistic. So on the economic front, that was number two issue, is going to be economic development. And I would like to see priority, special emphasis being made on increasing the role of the private sector into Africa transformation. Because if you want to create jobs, and job is a national security problem in Africa. Yes, we have a shortfall of 74 million jobs that need to be created by 2020, I mean 2 years. For me, it's a crisis. So, and the private sector need to be more engaged. That means African government need to have policies that really make them more competitive. And lastly, is regional integration. Of course, the European, we see that protectionism going on in Europe and everywhere else, even here in the US. But Africa is doing a really good job. They have been very aggressive in negotiating trade agreements, and we hope to see the continental trade agreement being completed, at least the framework being done by this year. And I think it would be good for US in terms of export opportunities, because the market will be bigger, 1.2 billion, maybe 2 billion by 2050. For infrastructure development, for all those initiatives we have here, is a great opportunity, including legislation that Congressman Smith introduced. I'm just thinking about that. 2 years ago, Congressman Smith and Congresswoman Karen Bass. It was a U.S.-Africa Greater Export Bill. It created an avenue to increase export and infrastructure development in the continent. So in a nutshell, that's what, and of course, the youth and women, but I'll talk about women issue later.
Thank you. All I wanted to say, they just said it.
They left nothing for you.
But for me, and it's a priority I always have in mind, It has to do with governance, but in a sense of reducing the gap between good policy elaboration and policy implementation, mm-hmm. and having a sense of emergency on the continent that a good implementation, quick, decisive implementation is really key. Yes. And this year I have in particular in mind the oil exporting countries. Mm-hmm. You know, since 2014, oil prices have gone down. In 2016, they were lower than a 10-year low, mm-hmm. and with countries that are about half of the region's GDP, the Nigerias, the Angolas, and so on, this is really an issue that needs to be addressed quickly. If you take Nigeria, I believe about 75% of government's revenue come from oil, so you have suddenly a big shock, budget deficits that goes up. You have your current account deficit that goes up. And then you need to adjust in the short term. You need to take some pain medicine. And you need to take it quickly. But in Nigeria as well as in Angola, in some other countries, it seems that the shock has been treated a bit as a temporary shock,
right.
where
right.
it should be treated as a permanent shock. Reserves are dwindling. And rapid and decisive policy measures have really... We're not seeing them. It's taking time. There are hesitations. And how do you see that? You see dual exchange rates, sometimes even more than two exchange rates in the same country. You see arrears, government starting accumulating arrears and so on. Or even in the case of some SEMAC countries, which are the Francophone countries in the Central Africa, you see the government starting to borrow from the central bank. So all these are not the right policies to take right now. You need really to take a pain medicine. It's going to be a priority. But then while you do it that, you still have here an opportunity, as we were saying, do not let a good crisis go to waste. You have the opportunity to also diversify your economy so that right. in the future you can depend less on oil. You need to look at agriculture. You need to look at your services sector, your manufacturing sector, and so on. The third, so take the macroeconomic adjustment and in the short term. Second, think about your structural transformation, your diversification in the medium term. But third, I think also it's time to have a look at the social contract. When oil prices were very good, there were some winners, but there are also some losers. Right now that we have to adjust, really have to be careful that it's not the poorest segment of the society that will bear the brunt of this adjustment. So you need to adjust, but you need to also have some buffers and absorb the shock for those. So I happy to go into the details, but these gap reducing the gap between policy implementation and policy formulation, and then for oil exporting countries in Africa, really taking decisive prompt action
is
needed. Yeah.
Yeah. No, thank you very much. Do we have the results of the online vote? So we like I said, we did the aha. There you have. What did we get?
Yeah, peace and
security. Who won? Peace and security.
Peace and security always wins.
Yeah.
Economic development too.
You can never go wrong with peace and security.
All right.
Governance, yeah.
But you know.
Gender, youth, inclusion.
I think we touched on everything except climate change, perhaps.
No, we did not.
Climate change, yeah, it's there.
Yeah. No, I mean, from our discussion.
Yeah, we didn't touch climate change.
But finance for development, yeah, much. I mean, all of this, all of these were covered in the Foresight Africa research, which was an excellent piece of research and touched on many of these topics. So let me just get into some of these, because you can see the sort of priorities, what people are thinking about. I want to come back to Whitney to just sort of, and Angel as well, because you guys have a lot of experience in a mix of Capitol Hill and dealing with Africa and what priorities are. And when we think about President Trump administration and dealing with Africa, what do you think the opportunities are here? Because you sort of touched on some of them, and I just want to get a little bit more
about how this might work in Africa's favor. Yeah.
Well, the opportunity is vast. I mean, Africa, to me, is not only a continent of opportunity, but it's a continent of innovation. And if you take, for example, one sector, like the Nigerian film industry, Nollywood, right? Mm-hmm. It's the third largest content creator after Hollywood and Bollywood. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think if you look at the business model of Nollywood, which employs, by the way, you know, more than 1 million people, it's the second largest employer after agriculture in Nigeria. The business model is one where, you know, the writer, the director, the actors get together, they raise a couple hundred thousand dollars, they shoot the film in 6-8 weeks, goes to DVD. For every one DVD sold, 9 or 10 are copied. So the intellectual value, the intellectual property isn't being returned to the creators. So it's a question of how do you capture that? And I think what we're beginning to see is sort of the strength of the internet and the strength of, you know, there are 1 billion people on the continent, nearly 1 billion cell phones. By 2020, it'll almost be half smartphones. And you're seeing things like iRoko TV coming forward, subscriber service. Netflix has gone into Nigeria. So I think there's tremendous potential to use technology not only to capture value, not just of filmmakers and actors, but designers and other innovators. But in doing so, Africa begins to tell its own story, gets control of the narrative. Mm. And so it's not just Nigerians that are looking at these films. It's not just the diaspora. It's others. And there's much more of an exchange between Hollywood and Nollywood and Bollywood. It's just not a one-way street. I think there's tremendous potential in using technology to be an accelerator for economic development and to bring people into, you know, the mainstream of the African economic progress.
I think where I was going with my question as well was just this idea that, and we at Quartz had written a few things about this idea that, you know, Africa is just not a priority for Trump, right? It's just not something he's concerned about, or as you pointed out, experienced with, but almost in an even more dismissive way. That's the perception. I'm not saying that's whether that's true or not. I don't know. And the idea that whatever you think about America's role or the United States' role on the continent. They do have, the United States does have a kind of, you know, governance overview kind of impact, particularly when it comes to democracy. And the concern is, well, if you have a president who isn't particularly interested, then some of the worst elements of the leadership as that we've seen in the past will be on show.
It's true that President-elect Trump didn't say anything about Africa, and even the last election, Africa has never been in the agenda because the constituency is not there, not on the platform. Let's be real. And number one, number two is even if he has no interest in policy, in politics, you have to convince and pressure, and he has not promised anything to the African constituency because we do not support him, or we're very divided, I don't know. So we cannot hold him accountable or anything, and he's not sending any signal. But I still believe, if you look at his advisory board he put in place recently, the private sector, the economic advisors, all those CEOs are on top of companies who have operation in Africa. At some point, so when it comes to discussion, they will have to say something. And also, if they don't do anything in the next 3 or 6 months, I believe they want. They're already giving an avenue to Chinese and other places because the world is watching. Everybody knows he's not going to move. Even if he wants to, it's difficult because you have to deal with the domestic issues. So the question is how fast China, India, Turkey, and the rest will move in the continent. And the opportunities that the Africans have, let's also be honest, we need to stop expecting heaven to come from somewhere else. We need to take responsibility, and African leaders need to think about their own strategy. If you have the best legislation in place, if you don't have a strategy like AGOA, the countries that are really benefiting from AGOA won't have a strategy. Ethiopia, Kenya, Mauritius, and the rest don't. So if you don't grasp what we have and you don't go on the negotiation table, don't expect. There's a proverb that says you don't get in negotiation what you deserve, you get what you negotiate. So if you don't have a strategy, if you don't take advantage of the fact that America is not or is making Africa a priority, then nobody will be blamed. They need to think about their own interest, and I think it's a huge opportunity. And when you look at the current global, after the Cold War era, we have different source of power. It's not bilateral anymore. It's not the Francophone country dealing with the French system. People have relationship with countries in Asia. They have like negotiation everywhere. And then you have a trend today of having more South-South relationship. Almost every month, if you go to the continent, look at the continent, you have some conferences promoting South-South relationship. And now it's mostly inter-Africa trade relations. We need to trade more within ourselves. Right now, we're only doing 10%. While Asia are trading 63%. European countries are trading at 83%. So if we only double our trade among ourselves, I think we can have a better impact. So I'm not really concerned about this administration doing something for Africa or not. I think Africa needs to be responsible.
Yeah, I mean...
Do we have enough to trade with each other in our countries?
No, yeah, we're not doing enough to trade with each other.
Enough to trade with each other?
Yes, we do. I think we do. If we focused more on value addition at the local level, there's lots of opportunities for intra-country trade and intra-regional trade within Africa. But yeah, I would like to emphasize points made. One on the economy. Yeah, I think that actually Trump's pro-business approach might be good for the continent. Business and jobs are what end poverty. At the end of the day, and if he sticks to a pro-business agenda, that might be good, especially to the extent that it leads to American companies moving into the continent. And second, on governance, I'd like to, some people may consider this a heretical view, but I think that maybe Trump will align American rhetoric with America's actual policy on governance on the continent, right? So we can say all we want about the Obama administration, but every single time governance came up against American interests, American interests trumped. Governance. So right. we shouldn't be deluded that America will always be pro-governance. America is pro-American interests. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that Trump aligns the rhetoric with actual policy, that's good. It means less hand-holding of African governments. It means less time wasted on soft, fluffy issues that have no impact on material outcomes for Africans. And that's good for everyone involved, right? And in my view, I think that would probably lead to greater political development. So if we're engaging Ethiopia on getting stuff done, then it means Ethiopians are able to build systems that work in the Ethiopian context, as opposed to spending time, chasing governance and trying to put fires on that front and also doing other things. This is not to say that we should totally ignore governance, but that... there needs to be coherence in policy, and this is an opportunity for that.
If I just may maybe say something about global governance. So we had organized an event here with some South Sudanese academics and some U.S. Diplomats and so on, and there was a lot of angst, a lot of nervousness regarding South Sudan because the rainy season is going to... is finished, and then there are fears of a regain of violence. And one panelist, when we met, it was more a private event, but mentioned that there is a vacuum of global governance right now, because if you look at the world, where is the leadership coming? So in Europe, you have the Europeans dealing with Brexit. You have Angela Merkel dealing with elections. Here we have a new administration, which even if it has a strategy, it will take some time to be implemented. Then you look at regionally and you look at the IGAD countries, and Kenya will have elections, so one might think that they might be a bit distracted. Ethiopia is dealing with some local issues, so which leaves in that region maybe President Museveni from Uganda, which is one-sided in terms of his support, and then Sudan, the Khartoum regime. So there is, it makes us a bit nervous when it comes to that, and which means, again, that you know, the regional institutions need to really be strengthened. So one of the recommendation was to have the UN play a role, but the UN also is going through a transition. We have a new Secretary General and so on. So at the end, we all felt with the feeling that now is a very good time to do bad things if you are a bad guy. Mm. So hopefully it won't happen, but I mean, for the first months of 2017, I think the global environment is not very good.
Yeah. There are some members, a group of members, which each Congress introduced legislation to defund the UN. So it's going to be interesting this year and see.
But you know, I just want to go back to this issue of priority. Mm-hmm. You know, how much, and I think it's really important not to get too carried away about whether is Africa a priority or not, because I think in 2017, we're in a little different place than we were, let's say, in 1995, something like that. And I say that because when AGOA was passed in 2000, it forged this bipartisan consensus that the U.S. had interests in Africa worth investing in. And that bipartisan consensus, 2 years later, funded the creation of the Millennium Challenge Corporation. It then funded the $15 billion for PEPFAR. That was increased to $48 billion. And then into Obama, you know, it funded the Electrify Africa Act. That same bipartisan consensus in 2015 extended AGOA 10 years with a stronger vote than in 2000. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean? That means that Africa is a priority for the United States. There are all these programs in play. And so I think it's important to realize that, number one. I think the real risk is if, you know, the administration comes in and starts cutting budgets and start, you know, taking personnel out, starts cutting programs like the Young Africa Leaders Initiative, which was an incredible innovation, you know, and really helped the new approach to Africa emerge. You know, yeah, we'll feel negative consequences from that. But I think, number one, there's going to be a lot of continuity in policy. And as has been observed, you know, Trump's a business guy, and hopefully if he, you know, really focuses on the private sector, that will have positive collateral consequences.
I just want to jump on the back of the point about private sector, because one of the things I was reading in the report, the Foresight Africa report, was that U.S. American private companies are sometimes uncertain about African countries' interaction with private business, that they're not as supportive as they could be. And I just wanted to get some insight from you. If that's, I mean, probably something I haven't thought about in the past. But
so I talked to a lot of companies in the course of my work here and elsewhere, and I'm just, you just can't underestimate the misperception of risk that American business people have of Africa. Whether it's my safety, corruption, disease, you know, what's it going to be like? And rather than saying no, there's this tremendous market of 1 billion people. There's an emerging market of some 300 to 400 million. Services sector is growing, you know, 12-15%. You know, natural resources, of course, but incredible youth population that is just hungry to be trained. And so, you know, European companies know Africa much better. You know, Asian companies have a very different risk profile. I think we're constrained by our misperception of African risk. So if this administration can come forward with some way to address that and show that it's successful, you know, there's a population of about 800 U.S. companies located in South Africa, you know, some of the top U.S. corporates. But how do we translate that down to the small and medium enterprises and really broaden it out and go into solar and go into some of these more innovative areas that U.S. companies haven't been? Angel referred to Trump's President Strategy and Policy Forum, which is chaired by Stephen Schwarzman of BlackRock, right? Mm-hmm. And it's got 19 CEOs, and half of those CEOs had companies who are active in Africa. If that group could establish sort of an Africa subcommittee at their first meeting, which is supposed to be in February, I think Obama did a great thing creating the PAC, the Presidential Advisory Committee at the Commerce Department, and with the U.S.-Africa Business Forum that he held during the summit in last September, really bringing U.S. private sector voice into the policy dialogue. If that can continue, I think that can help a lot to address not just the risk issue, but the resource issue. How do you leverage resources to enter this market?
That's a really good point.
No, 10 years ago, the U.S.-Africa relations were always bilateral. It was really... the private sector was really absent until recently. You always have bilateral talks now between the Bilateral Commission under the Trade and Investment Framework. It was always government to government. But recently, we see more private sector engagement. We even see more African companies joining the chamber, joining CCA, joining the U.S. chamber. We have African-owned companies there. So when then President Obama held the first summit, you have more African CEOs in town than African head of states.
Right.
So I think that dynamic is changing. Even you from Nigeria, I remember when we were talking about local contempt laws in your PIB, Petroleum Investment Bill. American was all very nervous. What is local contempt? Why do you have to partner with local companies? Now, is it corruption in disguise?
Until we saw
Nigerian emerge and able to get into sophisticated transactions. Mm-hmm. And they became a valuable partner and to address even the risk factor. Because when you have a local partner, a strong local partner, he's there to stay. He's not going to move. He's not going to...
Right.
So whether the government or the country is in crisis or not, that's their country. So they capture, they absorb the risk better. And that makes the partnership with America more effective. Right. And it creates that win-win that we can easily measure because... A private business. They don't think policy, they think business. You know, is it profitable or not? So easy to say if a relationship works or not. Well, the government has created the framework and the platform for those partnerships. So you have Dangote and Blackstone. You have many examples of serious partnership like that.
One of the few topics that wasn't dealt with in a lot of detail in the report, which was excellent, that we obsess a lot about, it quotes is China's role in Africa. And we've kind of you briefly touched on it, but I'm interested, Amadou, in just getting some sense of how that might be changing or evolving, given China's own issues and challenges right now. How are you seeing it?
So I think China's strategy in Africa has been set and they are executing. One interesting thing, one collateral, positive collateral issue is that the interest in Africa, in Washington, is positively correlated to China's presence in Africa. Yeah. Every time, actually, I can say that now, but every time I see the audience a bit bored, I say China, and everybody's interested.
Joking. No.
But
it's true.
But I think the thing is China is investing in Africa. It's not just investing in natural resources.
Right.
It's investing in a broad in a broad array of sectors.
So they're doing that diversifying of the economy that you're talking about.
Yeah, and there are some areas where they're the only one really there. If you want to build railroad, usually it will be a Chinese investment. So We'll see. I think one interesting question might be maybe what happens to governance now that we have a new president here and so on. But overall, from the Chinese perspective, I don't see them changing anything, really.
Yeah. So, and to come back to the report again, to your, if I'm an investor right now and I'm thinking about Africa, where should I be? What are your top picks?
So I think it depends, and mm-hmm. the people who actually invest real money, unlike me, will pitch in. Yeah. But I think it depends on in what sector you are, and are you, you know, is it a macro play? Is it a sectoral play? And so on. If it is a macro play, definitely you have, if you take the top 10 fastest growing countries in Africa, they all have growth rate higher than 5%. Mm-hmm. Cote d'Ivoire at 8%, Ethiopia just below that. Ghana coming back, roaring. So that's the macro play. If you take a sectoral play, I mean, you could think about renewable, for example, or how about telecom? And, although we all have two mobile phones now in Africa, we still don't have access to internet as much as in the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot to be done. But my main conclusion would be that, you know, to invest in Africa, you really need to take a granular approach. And do your homework, and it can pay.
So it's more about an investment in sectors rather than investment in a country. I don't look at Cote d'Ivoire and say, well, it's 8%, so therefore I, you know.
Yeah, well, if so, for example, if it is, I don't know, if you're investing in equity or in bonds and so on, okay, that would be more a macro play, and you would go in country or in region. Yeah.
So are you nervous about Cote d'Ivoire in particular, given what's just happened in the last...
Yeah, so Cote d'Ivoire is interesting. In the short term, I'm not nervous about Cote d'Ivoire because they just had a mutiny, an army mutiny, which was they negotiated.
It's
and
a great thing about Africa. You can just casually mention a mutiny in the army. Like, no big deal.
No big deal. Exactly. So in the short term, I think Cote d'Ivoire... Although from a low base, right? But it's the fastest growing country this year in 2017 and so on. But in the medium to long term, I think the mutiny is a reminder that the dividends, the peace dividends, the economic dividends have to be shared, and we need to invest also as much as in the governance in institutions as we invest in infrastructure and so on.
Yeah. So which brings me on to talking about investments and the sort of the demographic dividends, if you want, and youth, which you mentioned, Angel. What needs to happen? Because you look at these numbers, you look at the youth numbers for Africa, and you look at the rate at which the economies are growing and the rate at which populations are growing, and there's clearly a problem here if something doesn't change soon. What do you think needs to happen?
I think we need to make African economies competitive and the private sector competitive. That will require fiscal policy, trade and investment, climate that need to be improved, rule of law, the stability of the transactions, the judiciary systems, all these things that need to be strengthened so that the private sector, when an investor comes in, it can play in long term, it can play with predictability. Mm-hmm. Because it's more important to have a lower return on investment in a country when you have better predictability than to have a highest return investment when you don't know. So. And we need to. African countries need to work on that. And the countries, especially East Africa, are doing a better job. And I think the investment flow will be more. Investors will be inclined to move fast in East Africa, Ethiopia, Kenya, and despite the fact that you have election. But I think the economies are still very strong. The West Africa region, ECOWAS, is going strong as well. With Senegal and Cote d'Ivoire taking the lead. And then Nigeria, of course, is still the elephant in the room, but it's still a big market, regardless of the fact that they're going into a recession. But it's still a big country to watch. Unfortunately, then you have Central Africa, where I'm from, in the Gulf of Guinea region, where you have Central African Republic is in trouble. Next to it, you have Chad, the same thing with Boko Haram with Nigeria. You have Gabon, the very small country, Equatorial Guinea, suffering from the loss of revenue for the oil and gas issues. Angola, we don't know what's going on there. And of course, Cameroon, my home country, who's like the pillar of the region. And they managed to maintain stability in an area where it's completely under pressure.
Right.
So it's going to be challenging. But I think the U.S. government is doing a good job in keeping their eyes and in those economies and without interfering directly.
Yeah.
But as I said, no, we Africans need to do a better job in thinking about long term. And strengthening our own and our system, educating our own people about the importance of civic engagement and ethics, anti-corruption, and not just at the top level of the government, but you know, it trickles down to the civil servants, and it becomes almost like a culture. So, and then the youth issue also, I don't know how it needs to be addressed, but I'm thinking, I always say to want to engage people in those platforms, is that every policy that we put in place, being domestic policy or foreign policy, I would like to see a job creation index.
Mm.
So whatever you do, whether Power Africa or any other initiative, we would like to see a report done on how many jobs have been created in both sides of the Atlantic. And that's how we can measure it and for the interest of both partners. We don't want to see those kids sacrifice their life and try to cross the ocean because they're looking for a better job in other places. And, so it's a national security issue.
So I mean, do you, this whole play that we've been told or we've read about the demographic dividend of Africa's youth, is it ever good? Is it going to be real in some specific countries, or is there a way to think about it that might... The whole, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, might benefit
many young people. I think in the medium term, things will get pretty bad, to be honest, because when you think about it, the rate of urbanization is about to increase up a notch, and
so maybe 3.5% a year.
Yeah, and African cities are in no way able to absorb, the populations that stream in every day. And this is because, and it's also evident in what we've been talking about, nobody is thinking about the more boring investments that are required, water and sanitation, housing, those, it's going to be hard to attract foreign investors to dig up plumbing in Lagos. One hopes that the public sector in Lagos will figure that out.
You're right.
And so... that will be problematic, informal settlements in cities and the social and political problems that come with that. But in the longer run, I'm a bit optimistic because, to be honest with you, part of the challenge that Africa has had for the last, several centuries has been the problem of underpopulation, right? Africa is a pretty big place that has never really had enough people to power states or economies, right? And I think adding, say, a billion more people to the continent will create the demand, right? So if I am president in Nairobi right now, I could mess with policy because I know that people can grow their own food in the countryside and completely operate beyond, the normal policy processes. Once that option is off the table, then I have to think seriously about, if someone doesn't have land, if there's a man in Kibera who doesn't have a wife up country who can send in food, how are they going to live? And that quickly becomes a real issue that governments have to deal with. So the demand for, good policy and good governance will only go up on the continent. And I think that's a good thing. And quickly on China, governance will be a challenge, as Amadou raised. But I think China has done one thing that we typically fail to appreciate, which is show what's possible, right?
Mm.
So used to be the case that foreign investor would come in, take the oil, pay cash to governments. Much of that money would wind up in Switzerland and in the south of France, right? Now, the model is that part of it comes to the people via, you know, roads and rail and all these things, which shows people what can be done. So, you know, the next government that comes along that's not building the roads or you know, or maintaining the physical infrastructure that has been provided will have questions to answer. And I think from a public goods perspective, that's a step in the right direction. And if anything, you know, the growth that comes with Chinese investment will only create more demand for good governance, which will produce, you know, which again will push African countries in the right direction in terms of political development.
So maybe if I may, like, if you look at the literature about this thing about jobs, I mean, that's a difficult question. I mean, but one way to look at it is to say, well, okay, if African countries are growing, and we've seen some are growing more than 5%, is this growth creating jobs, right? And then it leads us to the quality of growth. Where is this growth coming from, right? If it is some sectors like the services sector that might have maybe a low productivity, we're talking about lots of informal jobs and so on, right. Is it really creating jobs? Does it come from agriculture? Does it come from natural resources in the oil boom time where we were growing but no more jobs were created, additional? So I think really looking at the sources of growth and how they create jobs and so on is really critical, and there is a lot to do. For example, I believe that agriculture, we have a nice viewpoint that I like in the report, which is saying that you need to make, excuse my French, agriculture sexy again. So to have the youth go into agriculture, right? I come from a French colony, so I can say that. So then you can look at SMEs. In many countries, SMEs are the one creating the employment, right? But a big hurdle is the financing of SMEs in Africa, right?
Right,
so how do you, you know, and banks, I mean, a bank which has 100 SME loan application and one big $100 million loan application might spend more time on the $100 million loan. So maybe we could think about, you know, fintech, all right, new innovation to get crowdsourcing, I don't know, but to get SMEs to be funded in Africa. And then it brings the role of technology, right? Is there a way that, what role can technology play in job creation in Africa? You know, we're talking about digital jobs in other countries. I think that's an issue that also we have to think about in Africa. And finally, I think about regional integration, which is free movement of labor, free movement of capital, and free movement of goods. And I think we need to be more integrated.
Yeah. On digital jobs, my own just sort of skepticism is if you are creating jobs that use digital technology, that's great, but I don't see how that solves the numbers problem, because what digital technology does is it makes things work more efficiently. You need fewer people. You don't often have more people doing these jobs. I mean,
so if I may, so not long ago there was a company here, not to name it, it was GE, that has a GE that had a GE garage and had showing technology,
right.
3D printers and so on.
Right.
It's really fascinating. So a 3D printer is very cheap now, I think $300 or so. But the big ones that can do industrial type of printing, it's as cheap as a car. As a small car, actually. So all you need is somebody who knows how to use the software, how to use AutoCAD and all these things. So right now we have an exploding young population, which is unemployed. So if the jobs of the future are in you know, these plants with only robots and so on, maybe we need to train them to be programmers and so
robots.
On. And yeah, maybe we need to train these people to have intellectual property lawyers and so on. If not, if we don't do that, right, unless China brings its plants to Africa, which is a possibility, what will they do? The whole world will be digitalized, and even those jobs that were supposed to be exported but are going to come to the U.S., let's say, right? Even shoes now are knitted. The Nikes, it's kind of knitted by a machine. So
you
think it's worth investing. I mean, at least let's think seriously about what are the right policies when it comes to digital jobs in Africa. what can be done, what will be the global competition. But apparently, I cannot program very well except for those in economics. But people tell me that it's not that complicated to teach kids to program. So maybe we can teach
them. I suppose my skepticism is not that these things are not true. It's that they create a certain level of middle-class jobs, which are great, but don't really trickle down to the large numbers. I guess that's kind of where I'm.
Yeah.
So China is poised to export like 80 to 85 million jobs over the next 20 years. You see countries like Ethiopia that is really doing a good job trying to attract those jobs to Ethiopia using export zones, using a number of incentives. And, you know, this is an example where Chinese firms have come and set up manufacturing. And they employ 2,000-3,000 people, and they're exporting to the U.S., under AGOA, they're exporting to Europe as well. So I think this is an example, you know, as Angel was referring, of a country that's really put in place the kind of strategy that's necessary to get those jobs that does trickle down. And
I agree on that. If we get Chinese plants, hopefully not the most polluting one, that's good. Mm-hmm. But I think we also have to think about the jobs of the future. And train our youth to be able to be competitive globally. And I think it's possible. I think there is something there really to be. We need, of course, more analysis and so on, but I think we should go ahead.
Yeah, and just a quick point on this. I think we should be, you know, all for new technology and jobs for the future, but at the same time, we shouldn't be too enamored by, you know, the attractiveness of tech and forget the boring stuff, right? You know, one of my least favorite words is leapfrogging, because, you know, you're not going to leapfrog indoor plumbing. You're not going to leapfrog roads, despite what we've been told about drones delivering medical, you know, equipment. Right. We need the roads. We need, you know, the physical infrastructure. And African governments should, the policy challenge for African governments is to figure out how do you create the factory jobs while also preparing your population for the jobs of the future.
Yeah.
And that's going to be a big challenge.
I'm also interested in this point about regional integration as well. Like, how does that create more opportunities, more jobs for young people. So
let's take the East African community, and let's take the point of a U.S. company. Suddenly, if you think East African community, you're thinking about 100 plus million, 650 million people, rather than the Rwandan market.
Right.
So if Rwanda is able to position itself as the hub for the EAC in some types of sector, Rwanda wins, EAC wins, Americans wins. So it's more in this type of bigger market and really having economies of scale too.
Right.
And then there's another benefit. So if you're an African company and you're selling into a regional market, that's going to give you the expertise, that's going to give you the financial depth to then go into the global market.
Global market, right.
And I would say regional value chains. We all talk about global value chains, but we had a viewpoint last year or the year before about regional value chains and the importance for African countries to exploit the regional value chains. And I always, you've heard that before from me, but it's about like cassava. I mean, do Americans eat cassava? Not much, but we do, right? So we do. So how about having, a whole regional value chain for cassava? And actually, I hear you can do beer with it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Also, there's only one sector that we have not touched upon is the agricultural sector.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The potential of growth is huge. And then, of course, I'm going to use my women's hat because I'm a women advocate. I will be remiss if I don't talk about that. Women control 83% of the agricultural sector in Africa. Yeah. Not control, involve.
Yeah.
They represent the into farming, processing, and marketing. And yet, they don't have access to credit. Yeah. They don't have ownership of the land because you still have some customs barriers, and the infrastructure is not there. So if we manage to give more incentive and create an environment where women can can grow in the agricultural sector. What you do is, number one, you address the food security issues that we have. Number two, we also address the climate change issues because we invest in technology, irrigations, water productions, and nutrition. And that will have a trickle effect in the entire economy. And I thought I need to mention that. If you don't empower that segment of the population, it's almost like you voluntarily decide to use half of your brain and expect to be effective. So right now, women are close to 60% of the population. They contribute 83% of the economy. It's a sin not to empower them. To me, it's a top priority.
Okay. The bigger half of the brain.
I wanted to sort of touch on, I mean, one of the things that we at Quartz really care about a lot and we talk about is innovation on the continent. And one of the biggest challenges, particularly when you want to scale or you want to really start to have, particularly when you're doing consumer-facing technology, or innovation, I should say, is regulation. You know, African regulators, and I think I can say this broadly based on a number of stories, a number of experiences that we've observed, tend to be somewhat conservative and very careful and push back a lot on any number of kind of new ideas or new ways of doing things. Sometimes it's not necessarily innovation from their home countries, but some, you know, and it's an international company or what have you. Let me put this to you, Ken. How do you think governments should approach this? And you know, one good context, one good example is M-Pesa in Kenya, where essentially, you know, the reason M-Pesa was as successful as it was so early on was almost because the government almost sort of took a step back and went, you guys, you know, after initially sort of being nervous about it, they sort of had a hands-off approach, broadly speaking. So do you think that's a model that governments should follow? How should we be thinking of evolving African regulators?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the traditional channels of approaching regulation would apply in the African context as well. So, you know, one of the least talked about elements of the Safaricom and Pesa success is that the government is a shareholder in Safaricom, right? So they had skin in the game, and they wanted to make sure that the project succeeded.
Right.
And Safaricom, I think the board was very smart in terms of their non-market strategies because, you know, I think that African governments have concerns that all governments have about, you know, new ideas and technology. And so it's incumbent upon innovators to think critically about, you know, politically compatible ways of implementing the technologies, right? People are innovating in China despite their restrictive political space. People are innovating in Russia to some extent. It's possible on the African continent to innovate even in places where governments may not be as open. That said, you know, there are places, you know, Nigeria, Kenya, South Africa, that are open enough that can provide platforms to try out some of the new technologies. But innovators shouldn't assume that, you know, governments have their best interests at heart. Governments have their own interests at heart. And so, you know, the usual games apply and the usual rules apply that you convince the government that this is good for you. I would say that especially this year, you know, last year, several African governments shut down the internet around elections or around particular crises. Kenya is up this year. Kenya has tried very hard to style itself as the Silicon Savannah. I'm curious to see if the government does the same, because that would signal, you know, a half-hearted commitment to technology as a way forward.
Yeah, that's certainly something that we've had quite a few stories about. I think there were 11 countries last year that shut the internet down during elections or protests. Okay, should get that. Should we take, I think it's now time up. We're going to take questions from the audience. Yeah, questions. Someone right there.
My name is Aurel Mbeji. I'm from Benin. Just a former official for Benin. And I listened to the intervention, and very good.
Speak up a little bit.
I listened to your presentation. It was very good. And I look at the priorities. The fight of corruption should be also a priority. That because that's a key for my personal experience. That's the key issue why American company cannot do business in Africa. So I would like to
I think that's one question on that we one. Talked about this. Thank you.
Should I take this?
Yes.
Yeah, so you know, I'm not pro-corruption. I should preface my comments. I'm not pro-corruption, but I don't think corruption is the biggest impediment to development or investment, right? And this goes back to the question of political risk that Whitney was talking about. You know, companies from China, from France, from the UK are doing big business in Africa and making lots of money in the process. So anyone who stays out because of a fear of political risk, it's their own loss. So American companies should move into Africa and find ways to deal with the problem of corruption. And from the governance side, corruption doesn't consume as much as we think it does out of public expenditure. The bigger problem is the fact that African governments are not spending what is not stolen well, right? If 10% is stolen, we still have 90% to spend. How are we spending that 90%? You know, why is it that Zambia routinely returns money to the treasury because only about, you know, 50 to 70% of it is absorbed by state agencies? That's a much bigger scandal. You know, corruption is bad for moral reasons, and you know, but I think from an administrative perspective, we should focus more on, you know, how is the money that's supposed to be spent? Because the more we spend, the more demand we'll create for expenditures.
And just to add to that, I would say the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act actually protects U.S. companies, because it means that there's only one answer to the question of, will you give me a bribe? And that's no, because they'll go to jail or be prosecuted. But I think the bigger point sort of goes in the area of commercial diplomacy, you know, which the U.S. tends to think of as the deal. But really, it's much more than that. It's about transparency. It's about accountability. It's about rule of law. It's about anti-corruption. It's about skills development. And I think we need a more holistic view of the commercial environment.
So we just finished a report, which is available on our website, where we look at the different types of financing, so tax, foreign direct investment, aid, and others, and see how important is corruption in preventing those flows to come in.
Is this globally or just specific to Africa?
Specific to Africa. Okay. And we find for foreign investment that corruption wasn't a big factor, really. And probably it's because there's so much that goes into oil exporting countries that have lower, not so good indices. But the interesting result we have is that it was very important for raising taxes. So basically, if you reduce corruption, you raise more taxes, and tax to GDP was much higher than any of the other flows. So we are really thinking more of corruption as a domestic issue, that if you really do progress in there, you're going to raise more taxes and you raise more money through that.
Interesting, I think. Gentleman right there.
Daniel Press from Competitive Enterprise Institute. So my question was actually for Mr. Snyderman, although it'd be great to get a comment from anybody else. So although this is not a complete list of the priorities, it's disappointing to find that the importance of property rights are often overlooked from the discussion, even though it's incredibly important to development. So recently, your company Covington co-founded the Global Blockchain Business Council with the company Bitfury, which is a company which has looked to help countries like the Republic of Georgia set up blockchain-based land titling systems. So I was wondering how important you actually see the role of property rights in African economic development and whether the country should look to pursue these blockchain technologies in titling their land.
Well, just to say, I'm not involved in that project, but certainly land rights is, I think, absolutely critical. And I think that's really been a constraint on the emergence of the agricultural sector. The fact that the ownership of land is not possible in a lot of countries holds back progress on agriculture. So I think that's certainly an issue. A country like Zimbabwe, land rights, you know, has really been very important. And I think there's a potential to get long-term leases, 99-year leases. Those are good leases, and the bank can lend to that. That could really unlock a lot of potential. On the issue of blockchain generally, look, I think this is very important. This is sort of the future of as I understand it, of global currency and giving security in the cloud, and how can you make economic exchanges more efficient and more secure. And I think there's a lot of potential for these technologies in that area.
Okay. Gentleman here. Although I think after this has to be a lady.
I want to thank the panel for a great intervention. My name is Balakita. I teach comparative politics at George Washington University. My question is on energy. When you look at Africa, there's over 600 million people that have no access to electricity. You mentioned Ivory Coast, Cote d'Ivoire now, that it's a fast-growing economy where it's 8%, which is a good thing. But when you look into the country, Cote d'Ivoire, 3 out of 5 kids have no access to electricity in classroom. So it pushes them to not attend school. It affects school attendance. What do you think like African government can do to deal with the issue of energy and electricity? Because if I'm an investor, for example, and I want to go to Africa to invest, I want to make sure if I put my factory in the country, I won't have blackout. I'll make sure I'll be able to my factory to function. So what do you think African, sub-Saharan Africa can do? Because when you look at Spain, just to give one example, the electricity consumption of Spain is more than that of sub-Saharan Africa, outside of South Africa. So what do you think sub-Saharan African government can do to deal with the issue of energy? Thank you.
Okay.
It's true that the energy poverty is a problem in Africa, and there's a lot of high-level discussion to address that. And African Development Bank had made it a priority to electrify Africa. Here in the U.S., you know, Power Africa Initiative was $7 billion in 6 countries. The U.S. Congress passed Electrify Africa Act, to give access to electricity to in rural areas in all the 48 sub-Saharan countries, because the power penetration in Africa is average 20%. In some countries, like Benin, it's even 12%, whereas everywhere else in the world, the average is 63 or 65%. So we're really in the dark. But the question is how much money we're able to raise to address those issues. And the numbers, I think, is how much is $100 billion a year we need to invest in a year. So I don't think the African development will be able to leverage that. But China is, trying to invest in that sector, and it's one of the priority. But same thing is access to finance. Nigeria, for example, the country that I've been following, trying their best to they tried to until 2 years ago to diversify, to privatize, to make it more effective, and the power distribution, power production, gas development, but. It's not working. And at the same time, you know, we have these emerging gas producers like Mozambique, who have big, massive gas reserve. The real question is finding the right partners. If American firms, we all like to work with American because they have the best technology, business ethics. But if you don't marry the woman you love, you marry the woman who loves you. So okay. If Americans, you know, don't understand, they calculate the risk and they do all reports and it takes them 6 months to just study. And then I spend more time explaining to my American partners what the African context is and another half explained to my African partners what I'm making is, and it's really time-consuming and very frustrating. And those are not the challenge I have when I talk to Turkish. And it was, I went to the point where I almost have to say, okay, maybe I'll just deal with Turkish companies and not Chinese companies, a little bit more easier. Because when they go to Africa with and try to do business with the African understanding. Of course, no, we have ethical problems, but
yes.
At least they try to learn the language. The Chinese are speaking Igbo in the street and things like that. It makes things a little bit easier. Cultural understanding is the foundation for serious business.
I'm interested in the role of innovation in this, like how we...
Maybe just before we get into innovation, which I think is important, but we've done some work also at the Africa Growth Initiative on infrastructure. We have at least 3 reports on that. But very briefly, first one, when we've talked to many investors, there were a lot of concerns about project preparation. There were lots of complaints about the lack of preparation, of the quality of project preparation. But there's some movement going on. And in this viewpoint, we have, in this foresight, we have a viewpoint from USTDA, whose job really is to work with American companies and foreign countries and work on project preparation. And they're doing, I think, something that is useful. The IFC is also having a facility on project preparation, African Development Bank also. So there's action when it comes to just having good projects and bankable, as they call them, and so on. Mm-hmm. The other thing is the money, the funding. So infrastructure. So coming back to project preparation, so sometimes there's not even a local regulation. For example, when you take renewable energy in Ethiopia, my understanding is it took some time to have the domestic regulation and so on to attract foreign investors, but they did it. The other thing is how do you get the funding? And there, the project, the scale is an issue. Typically, in infrastructure, you have big projects, and typically co-financing is needed. So you need the local governments to pitch in. We feel that the African Development Bank and the World Bank have a big, big role to play, especially when it comes to construction risk and so on, and invest in this project. And then you need the foreign governments, and also you need risk mitigation. So MIGA is doing some of it. And actually in Cote d'Ivoire, MIGA is working with the Ivoirian government on PPAs and so on. And the other thing we are exploring also is the role of pension funds, local pension funds and foreign pension funds and other institution investors to get into infrastructure in Africa. And just for example, one of the New York pension funds has pledged to invest, I think it's 3% of its assets in Africa. But they will go and have not greenfield investment; it will be brownfield investment. Mm-hmm. But it's taking time. It's really taking time. But I think there's a good momentum.
And quickly on regulation, I think you know we underestimate the power of governments to scare away investments. Recently, the Tanzanian government, the president fired the head of the power distributor because he wanted to raise tariffs. And so, you know, dealing with government monopsonies that buy and distribute power would be one way to go. There's no reason why countries should have just one power distributor. They should be broken up. Even if not privatized and decentralized and owned by local governments, as opposed to being run from the capital. Yeah. And that will bring in market forces because the current setup, it serves political purposes more than, you know, the real need, which is to distribute power.
Mm. Can we have time for the last question? over there. The lady over there. Over here.
Good evening. I'm Alina Fitchkonde, working with the Malawian Embassy here in DC. My question is actually directed to Miss Angel because she talked about inter-Africa trade. So I wanted to ask that what are the issues that are slowing down or reducing this? Because, like, let's take a look at AGOA. It's been a success. But this issue has been discussed even in the AGOA forum, such that some countries could have done better if they were working together. Like, look at Malawi. We are a landlocked country. So we probably didn't do well in the AGOA because of transportation issues. Like, we were spending so much money when it comes to transporting our stuff here to the USA. So stuff like that, if, like, we're working together with other countries that have seaports and we had connected our roads, our rails, in order for us to be easily to reduce that transportation cost. But all these things were not done. So what do you think are the causes to the failure of intra-African trade, and what can be done in order to clear out this issue? Thank you.
Okay. The biggest challenge is Africa, it's like a choir of 54 solos. So we need a maestro. And that's what the regional framework is helping. Southern Africa have been doing better job than other parts of Africa. You have the SADC, all the regional discussions. And at least now that we have those platforms, the stakeholders can discuss about their strengths and their weaknesses and find a way to address them. Because some countries are good in textile, those are good in peanuts, and some countries are good with meat. Like, but I think Botswana have more cow than they have people. So we need to find a way to get all our strengths and resources together and make sure we leverage that. And the same thing, when you talk about regional integration, before even getting to the legal aspect of it, it's one side is infrastructure, building roads, having countries agree and to co-finance roads, regional projects to allow goods to move and people to move, the visa issues, and the AU is taking the lead on that. And then also you have integration of the people. And that one I'm very positive because our generation is really interconnected and then you're all closer to each other, you have connection, and then you can easily trade even online. So the union of the people is already done. We just need to make it legal and get it at the policy level. So when this regional integration movement starts with harmonizing policies as well for companies, when they go to one country, when they have one partner in Namibia, you don't need to understand the laws in other places. So that is number one. Then you have the barrier, the non-trade barriers, and then is the entire agreement itself. So they're moving in blocks, and the negotiation is ongoing. And then you have to sign and ratify. So that's where the challenge is. You have each country to agree and implement it. We have one example in Central Africa, for example, where they agree of having one passport and having a visa with the region. And then a month later, one country decides to stop it because you have too many Cameroonians coming to his country.
Right.
So implementation of the commitment is also a challenge. But at least the political will is there. The public opinion is there, and it's a perfect timing. That's what I think he will take the time, but it will happen.
Yes. But I would just add quickly that statistics don't capture the informal trade that exists in Africa.
Right,
so there's a lot of informal trade happening, like in Niger and Nigeria, and so on. So that's something hopefully.
Benin in Nigeria, Cameroon in Nigeria.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, that point that you made about Cameroonians being turned back at some other country. I was thinking about South Africa as an example. Like we already saw last year the kind of result of like people where there's huge unemployment of local people and then a wave of immigrants from Zimbabwe, Nigeria, DRC, what have you. And there's frustration. There's reaction,
frustration.
Rightly or wrongly.
Even though African countries are the biggest receivers of immigrants, but we cannot number it because we all look alike. So same thing for refugee. But the trend is already moving.
Okay. Before I go back to the audience, we have a question from Twitter. I think I understand what this question is asking. Let me make sure I have it right. So there are many priorities for Africa, but which entities are most responsible and or best positioned to act? And then says cities or central governments. So I guess that question about, there's been a lot of research and work done recently about the growing importance of cities as the world becomes more globalized, the cities are becoming more important in the way we see ourselves, more so than national identity. Do any of you want to take that?
I'll just say quickly, I mean, I don't think you can separate the two out. There are 50 cities with a million or more people in them on the continent, and I think there are about 5 with 20 million or more. So when you just start focusing on the urban area, it's a whole new set of policy questions. It's about services. It's about financing, you know, water and transportation. It's a whole different set of questions, I think, than we generally think about what's the macroeconomic policy relationship with the World Bank. So I think we need to sort of take those macro levels down to the urban environment and do a better job at that, because the cities just drive so much growth on the continent.
Last question. The gentleman in the red tie over there.
Thank you. My name is Bilqasem Nahi from Moroccan American Forum. This is a great panel. Thank you so much for these insights. But I would like to remind the panel that Africa is not just sub-Saharan Africa. It's there is the Grand Maghreb, which is the north, and the second largest investor in Africa within African countries is Morocco. It invests three sectors. The first one is banking, the second is the Morocco Telecom, and the third one is the infrastructure. I agree with the panelist when he said that the growth should start by building the infrastructure. Yeah. We have the largest in Morocco right now. There is the largest port in Mediterranean area and Africa. But its role, it's not extended to Africa. Why? Because there is no infrastructure. Beyond Morocco, there is no, we don't have highways. We don't have rail, you know? Mm-hmm. Road rails to Dakar or going to even to Ghana. where the problem is. The second one, I visited many countries in Africa within 10 years. You go to the city, you found that city is well developed. But 100 kilometers from the city, there is a village which lives in the 1400s. That my issue that I always ask, how we are going to bring that village from that era of the Middle Age to today? Is it by sitting in Washington and then just thinking about global investment, or creating think tank inside the country and then giving the authority for the think tank to study the situation and bring back whatever they study to us, and then we can develop the whole map to invest in that country? My question is this: how we as Africans who are abroad or who are in these institutions, can we be a tool of change for those villages, not just for the country, not just to build institutions, but those guys who are in the ground, who are suffering every single day, lack of water, lack of health, lack of education. Thank you.
Thank you. And, just to say, just before where we were in the green room earlier, actually we had a discussion about Morocco as a country to watch on the continent. So I guess that's a question basically about the rural areas, developing rural development, and how one.
So maybe I can use the example of a Moroccan company, which could help. That's the OCP, Office Chérifien des Phosphates. So actually, like in Gabon, they have this interesting idea that, you know, Gabon is oil rich, gas rich, and phosphates plus gas, you can make fertilizers. So the idea is to increase the productivity in the rural area by having a broader strategy about natural resources. So if you are gas rich, what can you do with your gas? You can sell it, you can liquefy it, and so on. But you can also have fertilizers, which then will hopefully help increase productivity in the agriculture sector and decrease poverty and so on. So this type of thinking, I think it's key. And the other thinking also is the nexus between rural and urban area, where we really need to think more.
Yeah, I was in Morocco last week. I went to Tangier and Marrakech last week. It's true that no, Morocco is a very. It's a good thing you're raising that question. Your policy is really right when it comes to Pan-Africanism and then economic model. Even on the look at where Morocco is positioned, the trade agreements that they have signed with the U.S. and the European countries in a way that created jobs in the country. So we tend to think that EPAs are bad or they're not, you know, we're not ready to sign or get into an agreement with the U.S. When you look at Morocco, you can tell it's possible. You need to know how to negotiate because everything, the cars, medication, pharmaceutical, everything is produced in Morocco for the Moroccan consumption and then maybe for export. So coming back to OCP and regional projects, you know, in Ethiopia, they have an agreement already to build a huge plant. Morocco signed at least 7 agreements with Cote d'Ivoire, 4 agreements with Nigeria, including a pipeline, gasoduct from Nigeria all the way to North Africa. So those are concrete actions that are already in place. And now the next step would be to have SMEs more engaged. It's already trickling down. So when I was there, everybody, all the Moroccan wants to go to Cote d'Ivoire, not just Mali, because the African you see in Morocco now that are doing business there are Senegalese or Malian. But now they started looking at Angola and other places, not neighboring country. So when it comes to rural development, on all my travel, the best model I saw was in Morocco. When I look at how they developed, they create a program for women, and even for men in the south, l'Agence du Sud, they came up with a public-private partnership, including the civil society, to promote produits du terroir, local production. It's not mass production, it's a product with the Moroccan culture, and then they managed to market it domestically or even internationally. And I thought it was a very interesting model you can duplicate anywhere else in Africa, les produits du terroir.
We are watching Morocco.
And the civil society is very well organized. No, the civil society involvement in Moroccan development is a constitutional right. It's not just in the laws, it's in the constitution. And that's unique. Bravo, Morocco.
All right, on that extremely positive... we got to North Africa in the end. on that extremely positive note, I'd like to thank the panelists for... an excellent discussion. Thank you very much.